I also just invoked the Defense Production Act to help facilitate distribution of essential supplies if necessary. We're working with Congress to provide major additional relief to the workers, small businesses, and the hardest hit industries. We want to make sure that everybody is able to continue on so that when we recover, all of these companies and these great businesses, both very, very small and very, very large, they're not going to be broken up and you'd have to put them back together. That would take a long time.
President Trump today invoking a Cold War era law to respond to the novel coronavirus. There are now more than 10,000 reported cases in the United States. He also said his administration is trying to stop the economic hemorrhaging. The dramatic drop in the stock market has wiped out nearly 3 years of economic gains in just a matter of weeks. The White House has unveiled a $1 trillion stimulus package in response to this. They're asking for $500 billion for direct payments to Americans, another $500 billion in loans for businesses. And Trump is hoping to start sending checks out in 2 weeks, $1,000 for every adult, $500 for each child, and that could be repeated in May if this crisis isn't better by then. Well, joining me to talk about all this and the impact COVID-19 has had on the economy are two people. We have Megan McArdle, columnist at The Washington Post. Hi, Megan.
Hi.
Also joining us, Ian Shepherdson, founder and chief U.S. economist for Pantheon Macroeconomics, which advises Wall Street firms and hedge funds. Welcome to you.
Well, thanks for having me.
Megan, what do you make of this stimulus package?
I think it is less than ideal. I think ideally what we would want to be doing is supporting the people who are really affected by this. I am lucky enough to still have a job. I don't need $1,000 a month from the government. That said, I think it's actually pretty hard to, in the time frame that we need, we're asking people to take heroic actions in terms of staying home. Often they're going to be laid off. They're not going to have income coming in. And we need to make it as easy as possible for people to do the right thing. So even though I would much rather see a benefit that's only really targeted at people who have lost their jobs or are seeing their income fall, I think it would be hard to figure that out in the next 2 weeks. And so probably this is the best we can do.
Ian, what do you think? Is this the best we can do?
It's not the best we can do. I'd like to see more. As Megan just said, I'd also like to see it more carefully targeted to the people who need it the most. But there is obviously a tension between the need for speed, which is extreme now, because we are seeing probably over the course of this week more than a million people lose their jobs. We've never seen anything like that before. So the need to do something very quickly is overwhelming, but that's probably not the best approach if this thing is going to last more than a few more weeks, which unfortunately it probably is.
Yeah. So would that entail then more than $1,000 per adult, like maybe just a regular monthly payment for as long as this goes on?
Yes. I mean, ultimately, if you want to keep people into something like the position that they were in before, then a one-time payment of $1,000 is not going to be anything like enough. I mean, even in the best case scenario that I can think of, where the virus diminishes dramatically by, I don't know, mid-May, so 2 months from now, and businesses reopen, $1,000 isn't going to cover anybody's lost income for 2 months. So probably more will have to be done. I think Congress has probably not yet quite got its collective head around the idea of just how bad this is going to be. But I think we're going to get some economic data over the next few weeks, which will be really jaw-droppingly terrible. And I think that really will bring it home to policymakers that actually they need to act much more aggressively. And a stimulus package roughly on the scale of the stimulus in February 2009 after the big crash in late 2008, that's roughly what they're talking about. So almost 5% of GDP, that's not enough. I'd like to see more like 10% of GDP. This is not the time to be parsimonious. It's the time to throw everything you've got, hope that some of it sticks, and then do more later. It's not worth trying to fine-tune this.
Okay, so give us some ideas of what you think they should be doing to target, to help certain industries from just flattening and destroying the economy?
Well, in the extreme case, you could effectively pay businesses which would otherwise be shut to stay open. So right now, just over the last couple of days, the number of people dining at U.S. restaurants, according to OpenTable, has dropped by nearly 90% compared to a year ago. Now, that's astonishing. No business can possibly expect to have any sort of resiliency built into its business model that allows it to keep going if 90% of its customers disappear. So effectively you could pay them to stay open, pay them the lost revenue, some of it in the form of a grant, maybe some of it in the form of a loan. But we're going to need restaurants when this is all over. We're going to need coffee shops. We're going to need dry cleaners. We're going to need movie theaters. We're going to need sporting facilities. We're going to need everything that right now is shut and receiving almost no revenue. So if we're serious about not coming back to a wasteland in 2, 3, 4 months' time, then we need to throw huge amounts of money at it and recognize that, yeah, there'll be some fraud and there'll be some malfeasance and some people who really shouldn't get the money will get the money. But these are all secondary considerations. And maybe what we have to do, as I said, is just pay them what they would otherwise have been making in order that they can still have some doors to open when it's all over.
Right. Megan, you wrote a column where you say the same thing. As a libertarian, you wouldn't be recommending this normally, but these aren't obviously normal times. You also talk about something called labor hoarding. And so for businesses that are still open, what is that and why would that be beneficial?
So the idea of labor hoarding is basically that, you know, during a recession, demand for your product drops. The kind of perfectly rational, self-interested, homo economicus thing to do would just be to fire any employees who are surplus to the amount that you now need to produce. And that's not what we see firms doing. In fact, a lot of firms will just keep workers on, even though they're not making even necessarily as much as they're getting paid for the company, because it's expensive to find and train new workers, for one thing. So when this is over, if you have sacked all of your staff, it's going to be extremely difficult to get up and operational again. But also because actually there's this stereotype of bosses and big corporations as just being these hateful people who would do anything they could to ruin the lives of workers. In fact, bosses hate firing people and will keep people on even when they're not really very productive at all because they don't like saying the words "you're fired." And so I think what we've seen so far is the people who are laying off their employees tend to be companies that are running on such thin margins that they just don't have the ability to keep making payroll or to pay severance. They just don't have the cash to do it. So what we should be doing is subsidizing companies to pursue their instinct for labor hoarding and helping them to keep payrolls going, even if the output doesn't justify how many people they have on staff.
And are there any particular industries or businesses you think should be targeted first that are the most important?
Healthcare production, obviously, right? Anything that is manufacturing, but those are going to have adequate demand. So restaurants, I think, are a big one. Restaurants employ a huge number of Americans. The demand for them currently, other than delivery and takeout, should be zero. And that means that a lot of waiters and bartenders and so forth will be unnecessary. But they will be very necessary once the economy has recovered. And so we should be looking at industries like that.
Ian, can you put this into historical context? You said that this is worse, potentially worse than the 2008 financial crisis. Is it looking like the Great Depression of the 1930s?
I'm not sure that's the right comparison because that lasted for several years and really only came to an end as production was ramped up for World War II. That was a very long event. And even the aftermath of the financial crisis in 2008 and the aftermath of 9/11 also took quite a while. The economy had already been in recession for 9 months at the time that Lehman went bust in September 2008, and it had been in recession for 6 months on 9/11. So this has come out of a very different place where the economy was absolutely not in recession. I was actually feeling quite optimistic at the start of this year. It was looking quite good. So it's been a monumental shock in a very, very short space of time. We've gone from jobless claims at a record low every week of just over 200,000 to next week it's probably going to be 2 million plus. And nothing like that has ever happened before. And so we have to think a bit more imaginatively about the policy response. We don't have the luxury of time. Normally you can see a recession coming. And so it's a little bit of a more thought through and leisurely process to get the right policy response in place. But this is completely different. And so it means that the numbers will look more dramatic because a whole cycle's worth of disaster is being squeezed into an extremely short time frame, and that's what makes it so horrifying. We're going to get economic data the likes of which we've never seen before, and I hope we never see again.
Okay, and we'll keep an eye out for that. Ian Shepherdson is founder and chief U.S. economist for Pantheon Macroeconomics. Megan McArdle, columnist at The Washington Post. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, how an Uber driver is trying to survive. It's really tough. And one local chef is helping laid off restaurant workers. Those stories next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Service industry and gig economy workers are really getting hit hard by the fallout from this disease. We're going to hear about a relief effort for restaurant industry workers in a moment. But first, for Uber and Lyft drivers, business has really dried up. Fewer people are commuting. Fewer people are going out to clubs, bars, and restaurants, mainly because they are closed. Also, it's a safety risk drivers face by having potentially sick people in their cars. James Hicks is a full-time Uber driver and member of the Rideshare Drivers United Organizing Committee. Hi there.
How you doing, Madeline? How's it going?
Well, fine for me, but for you, you're still out there on the road, still driving. Where are passengers asking you to take them?
Yeah, most people are just asking me to take them just kind of around. For the little bit limited passengers that I have had, it's just really been local places, nothing too, you know, interesting, not work especially. I did have somebody earlier today who needed to go to a rehab clinic, so that was that.
Mm. Yeah. But it's a lot slower than usual.
Oh, yeah, definitely. A lot slower. People aren't going as far. And that really kind of burns because, you know, we depend on people that need to go places, and with the city being on, you know, sort of a quarantine, people self-quarantining, working from home, working remotely. It really just kind of makes the whole thing really difficult just keep up regular business, you know?
Right. So what are you thinking? Are you going to be able to survive financially doing this?
To be honest, I don't know, because it was already hard enough trying to survive, you know, with them keeping our wages really low. You know, since I don't have a savings because they have been not paying me well enough to actually make money to save. We're in a very precarious position. I know a lot of drivers who are homeless and dealing with this, and, you know, imagine having somebody infected in your car and then having to sleep in the same infected car that you don't know is infected, and then possibly transmitting that to other people. It's, you know, it's
terrifying.
Terribly done. And
what about you, though? What about you? Because you are ferrying passengers around who may be sick. Are you concerned that you might get sick?
Absolutely. I'm worried about, you know, people who haven't taken it serious right now and have gone to parties and are, you know, transmitting it to certain people, transmitting it to me, and then I could, you know, transmit it to other people. I'm definitely worried about that. However, I'm hoping that I can get Uber Eats going back on my car. This is a new car. So with that, I can hopefully keep people out of my car, and I can just, you know, ferry food from place to place, which hopefully I'm just trying to figure out ways to limit my exposure while still making a buck.
Yeah. Yeah. So it seems like food delivery might be a safer option and maybe a more lucrative option, given the fact that people do want to get their food and groceries delivered now.
Yeah.
Well, best of luck to you, and I hope you stay safe, you don't get sick, and that you're able to survive. Thank you for talking with us today.
Thank you so much. Of course.
That's James Hicks. He's a full-time Uber driver. I want to turn now to service industry workers and a relief effort being waged by one of LA's biggest chefs. Nancy Silverton is co-owner of Pizzeria Mozza and Osteria Mozza. Nancy is turning her restaurants on Melrose Avenue into a relief center for restaurant workers who've been laid off or who have had a significant reduction in hours and pay. And Nancy joins me now to talk about it. And so you're offering to-go dinners on a first-come, first-served basis at another restaurant, which is right next door, called Kispaka. Can you tell us what's happening there?
Yeah, you know, first of all, I want to let you know, and other listeners know that this is not a program that I came up with, but I was lucky enough to work with Maker's Mark, who is actually funding this whole project. I think they are donating to start $50,000 in seven cities for seven restaurants to stay open and feed a minimum of 300 restaurant workers that have been laid off or their hours reduced.
Wow. And is it open-ended? How long can this go on?
Well, they've committed right now to 2 weeks. So they're mm-hmm. giving us the money to not only prepare the food, but also to employ, you know, the workers necessary to produce and package up the food. So, you know, for me, it's so thrilling to be able to obviously give to our industry, but it's also, I have to say, it's wonderful that I get to retain some of the people that work for me and give them jobs.
For sure. So what will happen? How will this work?
So you know, they have a guideline to follow. And so they're asking, you know, it's a limited hours. I think ours is from, I think it's like 5:30 to 8:30. You know, this has all come around so fast. I only got the call from Maker's Mark 2 days ago. And so we're really putting it together quickly. So I think those are the hours, but it's a limited hours. They are asking for nobody to come inside the restaurant because they want to maintain the distance and all the guidelines, the government guidelines of staying safe. So people are going to be lined up, but, you know, 6 feet apart. We're going to take the first 300 people that we can. And not only are we offering a meal, but we're also offering some necessities, whether it's baby food or diapers, toothpaste, toilet paper, shelf-stable, canned items, things like that are also going to be available. I think that each person that comes to claim a meal can also pick out two of those items.
Now, you have several restaurants. Osteria and Pizzeria Mozza, both of those are closed. Mozza To Go still open, as we said, Kispaka closed. All in all, how many workers have you had to lay off?
Oh, we have to lay off more than 150, probably 170 between the three. And don't forget, I also have a restaurant in Newport Beach. So
you had to lay those workers off too.
Yeah, you know, thankfully, we did have enough cash flow that I'm able to honor everybody's vacation pay. So everybody's getting whatever they've accrued that way, which is, you know, costly. I think for us, it's going to be over $350,000 that we are allowing our workers to take advantage of, you know, and then after that, they're going to have to go on unemployment.
What about for you? Do you envision having to close down the businesses for good? You're not there yet.
No, I'm confident, you know, I'm confident we will not have to do that. I'm keeping the Mozza To Go because we've always had Mozza To Go. We're a successful takeout restaurant, and I think that the community is just so thankful to come in and get food from us. And it's also another way to employ some of our workers.
Do you know what you're serving in these dinners? Like, what's on the menu?
What I'm really happy about is that we're still providing the meals that are to go are still Mozza caliber food, you know. So it's on a very, very high level. It, right now, what we're going to try to do is run through some of what we have on hand. And then Chef's Warehouse, which is one of our major suppliers of food, is donating a lot of food to us, like 50 cases of lasagna noodles. So today we're going to have both a vegetarian lasagna, which has a lot of roasted root vegetables that we have on hand right now. And we're also going to be doing a meat lasagna and also chicken thighs with a green salsa and rice. And then we have mashed potatoes and a really beautiful farmer's market mixed green salad that's just it's just beautiful to look at, you know, and I'm just so proud that we can serve the workers food that are up to our standards.
Well, hopefully you can keep it going because people are going to need food.
Yes, you know,
for a long time.
I do. You know, I think anybody out there that's listening that wants to contribute to that fund, we can stay open as long as, you know, as long as we have the resources to provide for the food.
So if people want to find out more information about this, where should they go?
So if you want to find out more information, you can look on our Instagram, which is at Osteria Mozza.
Nancy Silverton is co-owner of Pizzeria Mozza, Osteria Mozza, and Mozza to Go. Pickup time at her relief center starts tonight. It's at Kispaka, which is right next to all those other restaurants. And you can find out more information on the Osteria Mozza Instagram page. Nancy, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's say you or someone in your home woke up this morning feeling a little sick, maybe with a fever and cough, and you're worried, yeah, it could be COVID-19. What should you do? Dr. Michael Wilkes is here to tell us. He teaches medicine at UC Davis, and he hosts the KCRW podcast, Second Opinion. Hi.
Hi, Madeline. These are scary times, and what
they really
people
are.
Would never have worried about now has new meaning.
Absolutely. So, well, let's say you think you might have this. You have a fever, you have a cough. What do you do?
Yeah, so the rules have changed, obviously, compared to what used to be when you had a fever and a cough. The first thing I think listeners should remember is that almost everybody is going to get through this fine. 80% of people will have absolutely no complications. They'll have a fever and a cough just as they've always had a fever and a cough, and will progress through this without any difficulty. 20% will have a little bit more difficulty, and some will have severe difficulty. So let's sort of break this down. You wake up in the morning and you're feeling crummy. You've got a fever. You've got a bit of a cough. The first thing you should do is get out of bed and have a cup of tea and see how you're really feeling. If, in fact, nothing has changed and you're still feeling lousy, I think the first thing for you to do is to call your doctor, your primary care doctor. And when you call the doctor's office, they're going to take you through a series of questions and only have you come in if, in fact, you meet the criteria. And even then, you know, we at my clinic have, as of yesterday, had 50 tests, and we had a lot of people that met criteria. So we were even then screening for people that were at higher risk and met criteria.
And what are those criteria?
Well, a fever and cough and the risk group. And the risk groups, you know, include what everybody's heard about, people who are over the age of 65, particularly those who are over 65 who have something that's going to predispose them, like diabetes, chronic lung disease, like emphysema, perhaps cancer or HIV. Those are all things that are going to increase your risk.
But in general, unless your symptoms are severe, you shouldn't get tested or ask for a test because you might be taking a test away from someone who really needs one, or you might be clogging up the healthcare system, or what?
Yes, all of the above. But let your primary care doctor walk through that decision. If you do have a fever and you have a cough, you should call your primary care doctor and talk with them.
And at what point should you think, I need to go to the emergency room?
Yeah, so the emergency room is there. It's a safety net for all of us. And really, any time a person is feeling like they're going to faint, or specifically that they can't catch their breath, they should go to the emergency room and be evaluated. If they feel that it's so severe, they need to call 911. The only thing we ask is please let the 911 operator know that the person may be infected so that the EMS can take appropriate precautions.
All right. And so then you go back home, and then what do you do?
Well, then you either go back home or you have always been at home and they don't want you to come in. And now you need to do what grandma has told you to do in the past, which is, you know, drink a lot of fluids, try to listen to your body and rest. If you do have a fever, conventionally there are two groups of drugs that people have considered taking. One is the acetaminophen, marketed often under the trade name of Tylenol, and the other is a group of drugs called NSAIDs, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory agents, that listeners will recognize with the names of ibuprofen and Aleve.
What about alternating the two, taking Tylenol and then a couple of hours later taking an ibuprofen?
Well, conventionally, Madeline, that's not a bad idea. But as I'm saying, with this particular virus, there's at least theoretical reasons to think that that second group of drugs, the NSAIDs, may cause some problems for some people with immunity. So I would stick just with the acetaminophen.
And what if you're in your home and you think you might have it, but it's not terribly severe, you think you can muster through? How do you avoid not infecting other people in your house?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, the bottom line is it's really hard. But, you know, you can create a sick room. I mean, a lot of it depends on the size of your house or your apartment, but a sick room where, you know, nobody else goes. You want to be super careful to wipe down surfaces. If you're, you know, have the luxury of having a separate bathroom, that's nice. You want to be super careful with tissues, you know, and discard them in a safe place where other people aren't going to sort of get your cooties. And you want to wash your hands.
All right. Good advice for all of us. Wash our hands. Dr. Michael Wilkes teaches medicine at UC Davis, and he hosts the KCRW podcast, Second Opinion. Dr. Wilkes, thank you.
Oh, nice talking to you, Madeline.
Coming up, how to cook at home. KCRW's Good Food host Evan Kleiman has recommendations.
I'm just imagining people in all of these homes with their pantries and their refrigerators and maybe even their garages just burgeoning with food.
Yeah. How to cook a delicious, easy meal next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, with restaurants now mostly closed, a lot of people are cooking more at home now. For some of us, that is a challenge. Maybe you're not so confident in the kitchen. So what is the best way to cook in quarantine? We're going to check in now with Evan Kleiman. She is host of KCRW's Good Food. Hello.
Hi, how are you? This is such an odd situation to be in. I'm just imagining people in all of these homes with their pantries and their refrigerators and maybe even their garages just burgeoning with food.
Yeah.
And still wanting to pick up the phone and call for, you know, that pizza delivery.
I know, which they still can do.
Yes.
If they want. But let's say they want to cook from home. What should they make?
I really think learning how to make a minestrone is something that everybody should do. Minestrone is the thing that is vegetables, but also usually has pasta and it has beans. So it can definitely be a main course.
And what kind of vegetables and what kind of beans? Can it be anything?
Well, there are some rules. I mean, I think the template always starts with onion, celery, and carrot. And these aromatics, which keep indefinitely in your refrigerator, are the sweetness that is given to the soup. And you start with that. Well, actually, you start with olive oil. You put good olive oil that doesn't smell like a mouse died in it. You know,
that would be step one. Yes.
Yeah, that would be step one.
Mouse-free olive oil.
So you want to film the bottom of your pan, no matter how big it is, mm-hmm. with olive oil. You know, you don't want to put in 2 tablespoons because the olive oil is not only going to help you saute your aromatics, it also gives you texture and flavor. If you don't use enough, the soup will always be kind of missing something.
So what, like a quarter of an inch, or is that too much?
No, that's too much. Okay. Just make sure
there's a sheen, a healthy sheen.
Yeah. Then you throw in your diced onion, celery, and carrots, and you cook it over like a medium-high heat until they start to wilt. I add salt at this point because the salt helps the vegetables get softer faster.
Mm-hmm.
Then what you do is you add your garlic if you want to cook your garlic. Personally, I'm a weirdo. I add my garlic into the water, but anyway.
So that would be way later.
That would be later.
Okay.
Then we want to throw in the rest of the vegetables we've chosen. I've actually written this recipe down. It's going to be online. And I've given a whole list of vegetables that you can choose from, like cauliflower, any kind of broccoli, cabbage. You can add green beans if you like. You can add broccolini.
What about tomatoes?
Okay. So first you're going to put all this in your pot. With garlic if you want, if you haven't already sauteed it. You're going to add water to cover by about 2 inches and you'll bring it to a lively simmer. Then you want to add your tomato product. And by that, it can be anything. It can be paste mixed with a little bit of water to dilute it, make it easy to add. It can be a little can of tomatoes with juice. Or you can use any kind of prepared tomato sauce. You can use something you have left over in the refrigerator. And then you can add, if you have it, a bit of fresh basil and fresh parsley. But if you want, you can always use dried spices too. But don't make it too herbal. This is above all about the vegetables, which basically are creating their own beautiful broth in the water.
And then what kind of pasta are you putting in, if any?
I like to always keep a little bag of orzo, which is the pasta that is made to look like rice at home, because that's great. But you can always just break up any kind of pasta you have. You can break up spaghetti or a bucatini in a pinch. You can even smash some penne if you need to.
Okay, so simple enough. And then once the pasta is cooked, then you can basically eat it, right?
Yeah, I like to add some beans, too. You can
You can do canned.
I had some garbanzos hanging around because I had made hummus a couple days ago. So I threw those in. And then when the pasta's done, you're done. And you're ready to eat. I like to add a little extra glug of extra virgin olive oil when I add the pasta because it just gives much more lusciousness to the soup. And then if you want, you can serve it in a bowl with grated Parmesan.
Mmm, that sounds so good and comforting. And may I say, minestrone, the word, it sounds like ministering
it
to
is.
Your health.
It is. It's nice. The ultimate comfort soup. Yeah. I made it last night and I have some more today and I will be turning it into a curry.
Oh, okay. So you can repurpose the minestrone into an entirely different dish.
My thing is to repurpose until I end up with nothing and have to start over. It's a game I play with myself.
Well, we all need to learn that game these days, I think. Okay, so let's say you're looking at a big closet full of pasta. What is a really easy pasta dish?
Well, the easiest pasta dishes are the ones that are basically glorified aglio olio peperoncino. So pasta with garlic and oil. You put a nice little amount of olive oil in a little saute pan and put in as much garlic as you want, sliced. Usually for me, for like pasta, for one, I would do like 2 garlic cloves, but you can use however many you want. Add a little bit of chili flakes, whatever kind you like. Toast it a little bit. I like to throw in a little bit of parsley just for color and for, you know, vitamins. And then I add a squeeze of lemon and salt and pepper. So it's not really a sauce. It's really like a condiment. And then you pour it over the pasta. But if you start with that base, then whatever canned fish you might have in the pantry, whether it's tuna, salmon, sardines, oysters, anything like that, you can just throw in that pan, you know, stir it around a little bit. That base of garlic, olive oil, lemon juice, a little bit of chili, and salt and pepper, that is everything.
Okay, final question. How are we going to avoid the COVID 10, which is what I'm calling the 10 pounds I know
I think you're
we're all going to gain?
I think you're very optimistic that it's just going to be 10.
oh, boy.
For me, the game I'm playing with myself is how long can I just work through every single thing in my refrigerator, my freezer, and my pantry without having to refill. Now is the time to open up all those weird jars that friends have brought you from all of their travels and use them for something.
Yeah, definitely. Here's to the weird jars.
Yeah.
Well, Evan, thank you. You've been an inspiration.
Oh, thank you. Anytime. I love talking to you, Madeline.
Same. Evan Kleiman is host of KCRW's Good Food. Check out her minestrone recipe at kcrw.com. More specifically, kcrw.com/minestrone. So get that soup recipe there. Coming up, the new docuseries on Hillary Clinton, in which she opens up about the 2016 campaign against Donald Trump and about her marriage after she learned about Monica Lewinsky. The director is here next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
Now, the other day, Mr. Trump accused me of playing the, quote, woman card. Well, if fighting for women's health care and paid family leave and equal pay is playing the woman card, then deal me in.
Scenes from a documentary series called Hillary, now streaming on Hulu. It takes us inside Hillary Clinton's bid for the presidency in 2016 and also looks back at how Hillary got to where she got as the first woman to be a nominee for president of a major political party. Joining us to talk about the docuseries Hillary is the film's director, Oscar-nominated filmmaker Nanette Burstein. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Well, there's lots of archival footage. There's lots of footage that the campaign shot during the 2016 campaign, but also lots of one-on-one interviews that you and your team conducted, and of her in particular. And she seems remarkably open for someone who is famously guarded. What do you think her general stance was in terms of talking to you about the 2016 campaign and everything else? What was her general attitude about revealing things?
Well, you know, it's the first time that she hasn't been in public office or running for public office or the spouse of, you know, the First Lady of Arkansas or the First Lady of the United States. So she was suddenly in a position where she could be candid and share her unvarnished feelings. And, you know, she very generously gave me 7 days, ultimately, to interview her. So there was a lot of time to really have a conversation about things and not rush through it. I think it was an unusual experience for her because I don't think she is accustomed to being interviewed that way.
She's more accustomed to be interviewed in a more adversarial, antagonistic way. Is that what you're saying?
Well, she's more accustomed to being interviewed as a candidate or news of the day, where there's a right. quick soundbite and an agenda to get. There's not a long conversation about her entire life.
Well, the Lewinsky affair, if you will, obviously a key turning point, not only for her and Bill Clinton, but for the country as well. She does talk pretty, what seems like pretty candidly with you about it.
I was just devastated. I could not believe it. I was so, you know, personally just hurt. And I, you know, I can't believe this. I can't believe you lied. It was horrible. And I said, if this is going to be public, then you have got to go tell Chelsea.
Can you talk a little bit about that, whether or not how she decided to stay with Bill Clinton and her feelings when she found out that he had lied to her?
Well, I think it was one of the most traumatic, if not the most traumatic moment of her life to realize that, you know, her husband had been having an affair and she had to publicly deal with it. And they were going to try to impeach him. And she didn't know what to do. She didn't know if she wanted to stay in the marriage. She didn't talk to him for several weeks to months. But at the same time, she felt like it was not an impeachable offense. So at least from a political standpoint, she was going to defend him. I think he told me he was probably the only president to sleep on the couch in the White House for several months. So, you know, she ultimately made a decision to stay, and she has forever been judged by that, both positively and negatively. You know, she really is this Rorschach test where people look at her and judge their own life.
Which I guess is the larger thesis of your documentary. Hillary Clinton is almost not a cipher, but she is something bigger than herself. She represents more than just herself, and she knows that.
She does. She knows it. For better or worse, she has been, since she entered the national spotlight, she's been a lightning rod. People idealize her. People put her up on a pedestal, and people have vilified her and demonized her. She ultimately has made many decisions that has put her in the spotlight and has pushed the boundaries of what we're used to a woman doing, whether that's, you know, being a different kind of first lady and taking on health care and fighting for universal health care as a first lady, which no first lady had ever done before or since. Or, you know, running as the first major candidate as a woman. You know, obviously she knows she's going to inherit a lot of rancor and admiration in equal measure, but what I most admire about her is it never stopped her, no matter how much. She's just got such fortitude, you know, no matter how many challenges she's faced in battles that she's fought. She just continued to push the envelope.
Mm. Where did this all begin? How did she get this fortitude to begin with?
I think it was the way that she was raised. She grew up in a suburb in outside of Chicago, Park Ridge, Illinois, and it was, you know, a Leave It to Beaver type of setting. But her parents, they were tough. And, you know, her mom, if she was being bullied and ran inside, she'd say, go out there and go fight back. Go punch the girl. So I think she was just raised to be a fighter.
And she did a lot of things before a lot of women did, right? She went to Yale Law School. There weren't a lot of women in her class.
Yes.
Before that, she was at Wellesley and she gave a speech. I think we have a clip of tape of it where she made a name for herself, a national name for herself.
We feel that for too long, our leaders have viewed politics as the art of the possible. And the challenge now is to practice politics as the art of making what appears to be impossible possible.
Interesting to hear her voice.
Yes.
I bet. We're so used to her voice now. Almost sounds like a different person. But was that her first real political speech?
Yes, she had been the president of the student body, and they had never had a student speaker before. And they felt that in these times that were changing with the anti-war movement and the civil rights movement, that they felt it was very important to have a student speak for the class. She was actually addressing the comments of a Republican senator who had spoken before her, who many felt, you know, was not taking seriously the anti-war movement, was being a bit condescending to them as their place in wives and future wives and mothers. And so she just went off book and did this very inspirational speech about creating change and not just going with the status quo. And that caught the attention of Life magazine, in which she was featured as one of the new young voices of her generation.
And then she had a future that seemed limitless, right? She could have done anything.
She could. And she worked for the Children's Defense Fund. She also was on the impeachment committee for impeaching Nixon. She was one of the only female lawyers. She could have written her own ticket. She could have gone to D.C. and I don't know. I mean, there were a million career options that she had.
She could have run for office back then.
Theoretically, she could have run for office. She didn't feel that she could have run for office. I mean, it was very unusual to have any kind of female candidates then.
But there were, and there were female lawmakers.
Very, very few. In 1992, when Bill was running for president, it was considered Year of the Woman. Because after the Anita Hill hearings, six women were running for Senate and won. Prior to that, there were two women in the Senate.
Wow.
So, and that was in the 90s. There were even fewer earlier. So there weren't a lot of female lawmakers. It was still really unusual.
There are a lot of people who look at her trajectory and see calculation, or they want to see calculation.
Yeah, I mean, which is interesting because, first of all, I think she gave up a lot by moving to Arkansas if it was about her career. She had far more opportunities if she had gone to New York or stayed in D.C. Secondly, the idea that you could be a senator or president of the United States back in the 70s and 80s was off the charts. One of her classmates, who ended up becoming a federal judge, one of her classmates at Yale Law School talks about that, and she says, you know, during the second wave of feminism, you have to understand, when we were looking around, our role models were teachers, and we were lucky, you know, just trying to become a doctor or a lawyer was an achievement. The idea that you could become president of the United States as a woman was not even on their radar. It was inconceivable.
So when she was running in 2016 against Donald Trump, at what point did she think he could possibly win this thing?
I think it took her and everyone in her campaign and a lot of people in America by surprise on election night. I don't think that they ever took him for granted and thought, oh, we have this in the bag. But every poll in America showed that she was up. Even when, you know, Comey reopened the email investigation and then came back and said, okay, there's no there there. Even then, I think they still felt that they could win because every single poll was saying so. So I think it was a shock for all of them.
Did they shoot footage of election night?
They did not. And I actually asked her about that in the film. Why didn't they film you that night?
I don't think we wanted it to be, you know, it was so, I mean, if we'd been winning, they would have.
And then she makes this funny face.
How does she feel about it now?
Well, I think she wakes up every day hoping that we can change our current president and get rid of the incumbent, and feels responsible in some ways that he's in office.
How does she feel responsible? What does she think was her fault?
I don't know if there's a specific thing she can point to, but I think there's a sense of responsibility, like maybe I should have done something differently.
Because a lot of people have blamed Comey, for example, for reopening the email investigation, saying that that was a key moment. A lot of people blame sexism. I mean, you can't discount that.
I think it's all of those things. I mean, when you're talking about that close of an election, especially in the Electoral College, I mean, you can point to anyone. You can point to the Russians. You can point to Comey reopening the email. You can point to sexism. You can point to maybe they should have gone to Wisconsin. Like, any of those things could have been the deciding factor. But I think, you know, for her, I think that she at least sees that there was a silver lining, that the women's movement that sprouted up after this election, in response to the election in many ways, and the number of women that won in congressional elections, that, you know, maybe people look back and see that this was the thing that lit the fuse, that, you know, shifted our course and questioning, you know, what are women's roles in society? What kind of unconscious gender bias do we have? How do we want to go forward as a nation? And so I think in that way, you know, she is not feeling, you know, morose or tragic anymore. But I think she is feeling driven, like many of us, to change our current administration.
And what was going through her head right before she stepped on stage the day after the election to give her concession speech?
Well, she talks about it, actually, in the film. She talks about how just deeply upset she was, not just that she lost, but that Donald Trump was our president, and was he going to unleash all of these forces, such as, like, racism that he had been condoning during the campaign, and these feelings of hatred and anger and anti-immigration. Was that, you know, was he going to step up to the occasion, or was he going to double down? And she was really trying to hold it together to not cry during that speech. I think she didn't want to break down and show her emotions. She wanted to be strong because everyone around her was just completely just waterworks.
And to all the little girls who are watching this, never doubt that you are valuable and powerful and deserving of every chance and opportunity in the world to pursue and achieve your own dreams.
She finally got off the stage and collapsed in the back of the van with Bill and just said, "What just happened?" And then, you know, not long after, she has to go to the inauguration because she's a former first lady. And that was pretty awful. But again, she did her duty as a public servant, and she went and she kept her mouth shut. I don't know how she did it. I mean, you see herself trying to, you know, brace herself before she goes out into the public beforehand during the inauguration. And I did not envy her in that moment.
Well, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you for having me.
Nanette Burstein, her new documentary, Hillary, is streaming on Hulu. Well, today is the first day I'm broadcasting from home. Hopefully you couldn't tell much of a difference. We're committed to bringing you the news you need about the coronavirus, and we want to try to stop the spread of it as much as we can by staying home. So here I am at home. A huge, huge thank you to everyone still at KCRW, the engineers and the producers especially. They're working so very, very hard. So thank you to them. Thank you to you for listening, and I'll see you tomorrow.